Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Oh, they're ready.
They're ready.
That's what it means when that music starts. I should have taken my sweater off, actually. I'm a little warm. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood here in the studio in Los Angeles trying to figure out where to look.
On the radio.
It's so awkward.
Don't look at me.
Just right there.
Oh, my God. Who are you and what are you doing in my studio? Anyway, so this is, believe it or not, the 100th time we have done this little rodeo. So it's 100 episodes of Make Me Smart because, you know, we're doing it with you. None of us is as smart as all of us, as we like to say.
100 episodes. Who would have thought we'd ever get this far? Shout out to Jenny Josephson, who's not here anymore.
But she better be listening.
Better be listening.
I'm going to go away and take my headphones off and take my sweater off because I'm hot, but you keep going.
Okay. See, this is why I never come to Los Angeles, because it gets weird so fast.
I will maintain my dressed state. I'm just taking my sweater off.
We will explain, actually, why this is important later. Today's show, it's not a big celebration. We're going to have a real show, just like we always do. We're going to get smart together about a topic. In this case, our nominal news peg is the Oscars, which are approaching on February 24th, and the award show has been in some turmoil. There's even turmoil breaking as we're headed into this podcast, we'll talk about in a moment with our guest. The Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts, and Sciences recently announced that the broadcast is hostless, host-free. That was after the whole Kevin Hart drama, which you can Google or DuckDuckGo. There has been controversy surrounding the film Green Book, racking up so many nominations despite the film's inaccuracies and pretty problematic depictions of race. The Best Director nominees are still all men. And then, of course, there was this debacle where the Academy introduced a Best Popular Film category, which it promptly dumped.
Well, because it was a terrible idea.
Can we just say
it was a terrible idea? And I'm actually going to ask Wesley about that.
We have so many questions.
We're giving the guest away. This is going to be a 4-hour podcast, people. Anyway, all of which is to say that the Oscars are in some state of unrest around race and gender inclusion. And it's been the case, honestly, since we've been doing this podcast, right? All, you know, back to episode one. I'm sure there was stuff going on back then. If you remember April Rain, who created the hashtag OscarsSoWhite a couple of years ago, we had her on the podcast. Last year, and I was reminded of this because frankly I had forgotten, I had suggested that possibly the Me Too movement was going to devolve into something not just about women, but would foster larger conversations about race. Not sure that's happened as intentionally as perhaps it should have. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting time.
Maybe not devolve, but evolve.
Evolved, right.
Yes.
Sorry, yeah.
Uh-huh. I'm just going to help you out there.
Yep.
So this is sort of like the context in which we want to revisit that conversation. And then, of course, the Grammys were on Sunday, and there are never not issues with the Grammys and race and gender and the Grammy broadcast. I would argue, I thought, did better. If you had just landed on Earth, or you were like my 12-year-old son and you watched the Grammys for the first time, you'd probably be like, oh, this is a world in which almost everyone is represented. That seems great. But there were still some notable misses.
So here's what we're going to do. We have a friend of Marketplace, the radio program, on the pod today. His name is Wesley Morris. He's a critic at large at the New York Times. He hosts the New York Times culture podcast, Still Processing. And he's an all-around thoughtful dude, which is why we wanted to have him on the pod. Wesley? You there?
I am. Hi, you guys.
Hey, how are you?
Excited? You excited about this conversation?
I'm coming down from the Grammys. I'm coming down from Little Grammys High.
All right. How was our summary of the state of the Oscars? Was it accurate?
Seems right.
Yeah.
Seems right. I mean, it's a mess.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just, Kai is not going to be surprised when I say this, but I don't enjoy the way that I don't think this is the tail wagging the dog or anything. I think this is like one of the dogs in the kennel. But I do sort of feel like all of the pressure that's on these now 9,200 people to, quote, do the right thing, unquote, it sort of gets in the way of like what an actual good movie is and versus what a representative movie is.
That's so 9,200 people is the size of the Academy. Is that like voting membership or something?
It is now. Wow. Yep. 9,200 people as of, I mean, it actually might be more because that's a 2018 number. It's probably closer to like 95 or 9,600.
But you remember they added like 1,000 people a year ago. One assumes to make it better along the lines of the conversation we're having and how are we doing so far?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you mean by better. I mean, they added, I think it was, almost 928 people, almost 1,000 people they added in 2018. Right. And, you know, but Kai and Molly, you know, the number, it really, I mean, so 38% of those people who came in 2018 were people of color, non-white people, as I prefer to say. And then that takes the number from 13% in 2017 to 16% in 2018. And it's funny because I was reading this and I was like, 38% non-white people. That's exciting. Yeah.
Right.
But no, it's not. It's just of the new class of people who've just been invited to join the Academy. Though that's 38%, and the number is now 16%. And for women, want to hear something great about women?
Yeah.
Boy, I can't wait. Yeah. So, hit me.
So 49% of the new membership invitees are women.
Yeah.
And that means that the Academy is now 31% women. Wow. As opposed to these are still 2018 numbers. But in 2017, that number was 28%. So go figure.
Mm. Wow, it feels like the tech industry all over again here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's still not getting us anywhere closer to having more women nominated for things like Best Director. Right. I mean, which is the thing that you really want to pay attention to is like how many women in a year, like come November, are in the conversation about being a directing nominee?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because that to me is like I mean, I'm sure that people in the industry would say that there are other important barriers for women to break. I mean, a lot of which have to do with like, you know, probably sound and mixing and that sort of, I mean, a lot of the craft categories. But I would say is a front facing category with like some degree of star power. I think having, you know, Greta Gerwig, mm-hmm. You can count the female director nominees, I think, on one hand. So.
God.
But it's interesting because it sounds like on the one hand you're saying maybe it's unrealistic or even unfair to expect a big award show to fix America. But on the mm-hmm. other hand, you're saying also there's no way it possibly could because it's so not representative.
I think that the reason I come back to the Oscars every year and the reason I love the Oscars and the reason I've always loved the Academy Awards is because no matter who's nominated, it is still telling a version of the story of both the movie industry in this country, because the people who vote for these awards and the people who nominate the nominees are people who make the movies in the first place. And that is a big deal. And the other reason to love it is it tells the story of America.
Hmm. Okay.
And like, mm-hmm. and all the problems that this country has and will continue to have. And it's not up to the Academy to solve those questions. But and I guess we can get into this later, but like, I think the movies do have a responsibility to reflect some of those problems in an honest way. And I don't think that the Academy is always willing to recognize movies that do that.
Mm-hmm. All right, so look, so let me give you what I think will be the first of several But Wesley moments in this conversation. You ready? And it goes like this. But Wesley, what about the thing you wrote the other day in the paper about Green Book, right, with Viggo mm-hmm. Mortensen and Mahershala Ali, as a historical parallel to and with Driving Miss Daisy, with Jessica Tandy and Morgan Freeman from many, many years ago?
Yeah, from 30 years ago.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and how race is portrayed in these movies that show up at the Oscars?
Well, I mean,
so first of all, let me recommend that column to everybody, right? Because it's really cool and it's really interesting and it shows great historical depth. But it does kind of go to the point where the conversation we're having.
Well, here's a version of an answer that I am comfortable giving. Well, only...
Okay.
Only because I do feel like it is illustrative of the actual problem, which is to go back to 1989 and look at the five Best Picture nominees, which if, off the top of my head, I think I can do. It's Driving Miss Daisy, Field of Dreams.
Oh, if you build it, it will
go. Born on the 4th of July.
Oh, good one.
Dead Poets Society.
Overrated.
And My Left Foot.
Never saw
those
that.
Are your five Best Picture nominees. But if you go back to that year and you look at what the nominated movies were, and then you look at this sort of the sub-level of movies that you got, which, I mean, not sub-level, but like the nominees that you got that weren't nominated for Best Picture, things like Crimes and Misdemeanors and Sex, Lies, and Videotape and Henry V and Do the Right Thing. Do the Right Thing was a movie that, in you know, should have been nominated for Best Picture. It was the best movie of 1989 as far as I'm concerned. And it was the movie that would, it embarrasses the politics of a movie like Driving Miss Daisy.
Which gets us to Green Book and that historical parallel, right?
Mm-hmm. Versus another Spike Lee movie this very year.
Black Klansman.
Right. Exactly.
Exactly.
So are we, talking about, and you guys and Jenna Wortham, your co-host on Still Processing, sort of talked about this, like the problem of the movie that is palatable to Oscar, the movie about race that Oscar voters are okay with versus the movie about race that
the white Oscar voters are okay with,
yes.
Although, I don't know, I've seen this movie with people of all races and they love it.
Green Book.
Green Book is a, to be exposed to that movie is to, it is like getting sentimental radiation exposure.
Right.
It's a thing that you just don't want to let anybody see it because they'll love it. And that's why it's going to win Best Picture, I think.
Oh, do you?
Oh, yeah. I think enough people.
I can't tell you how many people have recommended this movie to me. Across all of the swaths of Oakland in which I live, like everyone thinks that me and my kid should need to see this movie.
So, here's a good test for you. Let me just parenthetically ask somebody if they saw Roma and how they feel about Roma. People have no like if you get a Roma, like a person who doesn't like Roma wound up enough, they will definitely go on and on about how I don't understand why it's overrated. I couldn't see anything. And it's like so long. And that woman is so boring. And I hated it. Versus Green Book, where they're like, oh, my God, this is a story that makes me feel so good. I've loved this country. These two people overcome. they overcome racism and all the things that are happening
God
to black people.
Bless
and
America. Right. I mean, right.
This is like it's like you're describing the very. Yes. Right. Because on the one hand, you would make this argument that like this is the movie America needs right now. It makes everybody feel great about race. And then on the other hand, there's but it's super problematic and maybe just a big lie. And so then which side do you get to err on? Which feeling do you get to have? And can you have both simultaneously and not fall apart?
That's a really interesting question. Because the other thing is that Black Klansman is in the... Okay, not just Black Klansman. Black Panther is a Best Picture nominee. Black Klansman is a Best Picture nominee. And the idea that you would have these two movies, neither Black Panther or Black Klansman, I don't love those movies, you know. I mean, I really like Black Panther, but if it weren't one of the Best Picture nominees, I would stay in my seat. Yeah. I would not leap out of it. Hmm. But I don't think that there is something about Green Book that is just really, really satisfying to a certain kind of American who does not want to deal with the difficult stuff. And this movie makes it so easy for you to look the other way because it is looking the other way for you. Hmm. And you're basically asking to spend time with a guy like Tony Villalonga is a racist.
Yep.
And he's presented as a racist. He says racist things. The people in his life are racists. But this is one of those movies that believes in the healing power of prolonged exposure to black people as a cure for racism. And you don't have to atone for anything. You just have to welcome that person into your house for Christmas dinner.
So let me, as a way to pull us out of this rabbit hole of this movie, which I think is totally fascinating, but I want to know whether you liked it or not.
No, I didn't like it.
There you go.
I mean, but I've seen it three times and it does work. I mean, I understand why the people who like it like it. I just feel like it is cheap. It is, I mean, irresponsible is not something that I think a movie necessarily has to be. Mm-hmm. But it is kind of irresponsible with the story of this man, of Don Shirley's life. Mm-hmm. And it also is just, it is advocating for something that I can't support, which is like this kind of brownwashing of racism. And that racism is this cute thing that you can cure in, I don't know, an hour in 44 minutes or whatever. Yeah. I don't like that. Did you guys see it?
I did see it, and I liked it.
I did not because I got
those warm and fuzzies, man.
I know, and I did not because I reject emotional manipulation in all movie forms, and I only like things to blow up or be a Marvel movie. Jesus. It's terrible, but I just am like, I reject the feels at the movies, which is why I'm never down with the Best Picture winner, because it is always the emotionally manipulative movie.
It's not always. I mean, one of the things that I love about this experience, one of the reasons to love the Oscars also, is that sometimes, you know, that clock is right twice a day sometimes.
That's
and,
true.
And, you know, a moonlight will squeak out a win. But, I mean, Kai, I really do understand the whole that this movie, I mean, the movie does work. And Peter Farrelly didn't just start making movies 10
right.
minutes ago.
Right.
I mean, he's been emotionally manipulating audiences with comedy for 25 years.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep.
And he's really good at it. And I think that, you know, not enough has been made, I think, about the idea that this is a Farrelly movie and the like, and taking a lot of what's successful about those films and looking at it through the lens of this one, or looking at that movie, Green Book, through the lens of the Farrelly brothers project.
Right, which loops back to the conversation we were having about directors and why directors matter. And if you know this director's, you know, provenance, as it were, you understand this movie a little bit better.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think it's well made for the thing that it is. I don't like the thing that it is.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
All right, let's talk about the Grammys. You said when you came on that you were on a Grammys high, and everybody went into the Grammys with the lowest of low expectations. So it may have won on that on that by the metric alone.
Mm-hmm.
But
I don't know. What did you like about him?
Well, okay. Unfortunately, the Grammys immediately stomped on me, right? Like, I was watching the sort of beginning part of the Grammys, and I was thinking, you know, this is cleverly constructed. Like, mm-hmm. they've got, like, Shawn Mendes, bless him, and then Janelle Monáe, and then, like, a country artist throwing to rap awards. And I thought, okay, I can see what they're doing here, and I can see the care that they are taking and attempting to. And you had older artists and younger artists. And, you know, I thought, okay, if you just came out of nowhere and landed on Earth and you watched this, you'd be like, boy, there's something in here for everyone. And then as I was starting to think that, was like, I called it an anatomy of a buzzkill on Twitter. As I was starting to think that and be like, I'm going to take this risk and tweet about how I think the Grammys are doing a good job, then they immediately cut off Drake for saying that you don't need a Grammy, you know. Yeah. And then it was, and then J-Lo came and did the Motown tribute, and then the tide just turned, and then there was the best album thing that went to the country artist over all of these other kind of great nominees, and I was like, I don't know, maybe it was good album. Like, but
It was a good, I mean, Kacey Musgraves,
she's good. Right.
That is a good album.
I really like that Keep It to Yourself song she sings.
Unfortunate that sort of thing has to happen to a person like that.
Right.
It's kind of like the Adele problem, right? Like, when Adele won, when Adele's 25 won over Lemonade,
mm-hmm. yep.
and Adele herself had to apologize to Beyonce on national television,
yeah. Yeah.
instead of saying, thank you, Academy, she's got to be like, I'm sorry, Beyonce.
Right.
And that's just...
And Adele is really good.
Yeah, it's just unfortunate.
Yeah.
Like, of course 25 won. It sold a zillion copies the old-fashioned way by, like, physical copies.
Mm-hmm.
The industry loves that. Then the industry gives the award. And I don't know. Can we just back up for a second? I want to hear what your issue is with the Jennifer Lopez Motown tribute.
Oh, I just don't think she's that good. I mean, also, she couldn't really name any songs in the pre-show. I mean, she clear, you know, it's sort of like, if you believe that Motown is rooted in black culture, then having J-Lo do that tribute is weird. It was weird on a lot of levels. And then she kind of... But then I also thought, well, is this a clever attempt at risk-taking? Like, we're all so mixed up in our feelings right now that it's impossible to even know what to think about it. Like, if you viewed it as a clever attempt at risk-taking, then...
Which I did. I did.
Cool. You did. Yeah. Right. Then I mean, cool. I also was like, she doesn't sing very well. And then they're...
Well, I mean, I found that distracting. That was the best she'd ever sounded.
That's really
and,
true.
You know, I think one of the fights on Twitter was that it wasn't really her. And I mean, not only on Twitter, but everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounded enough like her to me for me to just be convinced that I just sort of let it go. I think it's a great argument for the impact that Motown has had on the world. Mm-hmm. The idea that Jenny from the block can go to the Grammys and do a whole Motown trip. I mean, I guess it's more interesting to me than having Fantasia do it, right?
Right.
Because she gives Motown the Vegas that Motown certainly can withstand.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then I don't know. Think that raises that interesting question, right? Like, which is fair for you to ask me. Did I not like J-Lo doing that tribute because Twitter told me I shouldn't like it? Or did I actually not think it was very good? And that's where I think some of this all gets really mixed up about what these award shows should do versus what they're designed to do in terms of the industry or reward ticket sales. And then how we actually feel, how we're supposed to feel, what we want to feel. Like, it's just, I think we can agree it's messy.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. This is why I prefer the Grammys to the Oscars, but, you know, mostly because the Grammys are like kind of like the equivalent. They're like thinking in real time in a way that the Oscars never can. And, you know, it was wrong with what happened. Well, I think that you just don't ever know what's going to happen once the performances start to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And right. I think that, you know, I don't know why the people who produce this show insist that so many artists change their songs to be piano-oriented and to be ballads. Like, I mean, it's just so weird that you're going to have a person like Shawn Mendes start a really good rockin' introspective song sitting at a piano. Like, he did sort of wind up on the stage with the guitar and Miley Cyrus. But every year they do this thing where, like, you know, your favorite hits turned into Muzak for the Grammys. But even the songs where, like, they did sort of try to gramify the moment, I just thought that was the best year for performance. That was the best bunch of performances from Post Malone and the Chili Peppers to Chloe and Halle, to Brandi Carlile. I just thought I learned so much about so much to her, who I'd never even seen perform live.
Me neither, and that was amazing.
She is for real.
Yep.
She's for real.
I added there's just 15 songs to my Spotify. I keep a running playlist of Love Right Now, was what I call it, just songs I love right now. I added 15 songs in the course of the Grammys to that list.
So you learn so much at the Grammys, you two. You're not going to learn anything at the Oscars, are you?
No. Yeah. I mean, this is the problem with the Oscars.
Yeah.
And the Oscars, like, when it comes to music, it's all the Oscars really have as a guarantee. And you're going to tell you've got Kendrick Lamar and SZA probably doing All the Stars. Mm-hmm. And then Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga are going to do Shallow. But then you've got three other songs that are nominated for Best Song, and you're not going to have the people performing them on the show. And one of them's from Mary Poppins, and you can get Emily Blunt to come and, like, do a production number, and you're going to say no to that?
Yeah. Well, and then before we let go, which eventually I guess we're going to have to do, which is heartbreaking, let's just address the thing that we just found out walking into the studio, which is that apparently, or I just found out, that apparently the awards for actual craft of movie making, cinematography, film editing, live action short, makeup and hairstyling.
Oh no, are you going to tell me?
Will be handed out during commercial breaks.
During commercials, yeah.
No.
Yes.
Yeah.
Are we
this
breaking
is getting
this news
worse
too?
And worse.
It is. It really is.
I didn't know this.
Yeah.
I literally, like, I mean, 5 minutes before we walked in here, and I am flabbergasted because how do you then find a way to continue to send the exact worst message to America, which is that it's all about the celebrity?
Right. So there you go.
But I'm sorry, what are they putting in its place? There's
No.
They're
putting them in the commercials so that the broadcast can be shorter and zippier for the watching public.
Oh, my God.
I know. Yeah. No, it's yes. it. I mean, that's really bad. Like, it really, because then you can't even say. Then everything that we, all the benefit of the doubt we have right. tried to give to these award shows with respect to them, you know, reflecting the industry and the craft right. and the ticket sales, all of that is out the window when you're basically like, no, it's about the pretty people, actually.
Well, this is sort of, well, I mean, it is interesting to make this comparison between the Oscars making that terrible decision to like having virtually no rappers
yeah.
and
yeah.
finding a way to make Ariana Grande not on the broadcast. I just, and then cutting off Drake was just symbolic of that place's problem with hip hop and with black rappers, I should say,
yep.
specifically.
Yes. The white ones are totally fine.
The white ones, white rappers are great. Love them, some white rappers. I mean, and it, to be fair to somebody, I guess, they did offer Kendrick Lamar and Drake and I think someone else very, very prominent and famous the opportunity to perform and they turned it down. Mm-hmm. I think it might have been, maybe it was Jay-Z. Jay-Z was last year. But, I mean, I think that there's a little bit of protest about the way the hip-hop artists are treated both by the Academy and by... Well, mostly by the Academy.
Yeah.
And the idea that they don't take it seriously enough.
So the arts and entertainment awards industry, to wrap this up, it's a mess. It's a mess.
It's a mess. And that's why the ratings are down every year.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is that people just don't really want to... Nobody wants to watch people do HR on national television,
right.
live national
right.
television.
Right.
Who mm-hmm. wants to watch that?
Right.
You can get that at work.
Hmm. All right. We got to go. We got to go. We got to go.
Yeah, we got to go. Wesley, thank you so much. Still Processing is the podcast that he co-hosts. And of course, you know, New York Times.
And the New York Times.
Yeah.
You know.
And thank you. What a delight, Wesley.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for
your
time.
I'll come back anytime
Appreciate
you
it. We'll
ask.
Talk to you soon. Well, that was good. That was
I know.
Good.
I think it's such a good observation at the end that it's a mess. And what I'd like to hear from you, email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org, mm-hmm. is, are you going to watch? Did you watch the Grammys? And do you think it's more or less a mess than kind of America or your HR department at work? I mean, is it, mm-hmm. is it, you know, reflective mm-hmm. in the way that it's been accused of being?
Yeah.
And are we seeing it attempt badly to correct?
And we'll get them on before the Oscars, which are, once again, the 24th. Anyway, it's makemesmart@marketplace.org, a break, and then we go on.
Mm-hmm.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
The frosting is so good, though.
I know.
I'm sort of glued my mouth shut.
So what you guys don't know out there in podcast land is that we're having 100th anniversary episode cake.
We're having cake
in here.
They got us a cake. It has
it's
our
awesome.
Pictures on it.
And it's pretty good.
It has like a silk screened mm-hmm. image of the album art. I took a photo with my iPad.
And I am not a cake at 11:30 in the morning guy. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty tasty.
Are you gonna have like a sugar crash later? How bad is this gonna get?
I don't know. Let's hope I can last 2 more hours
uh-huh.
on the radio. Anyway, so
we're celebrating
100th episode. Not everybody in this podcast actually listens all the way to the end of all the other podcasts. Even though we have good stuff at the end of our podcast,
mm-hmm.
which is me and Molly talking about Daniel Ramirez and Ben Tolliday. Ben Tolliday, I have cake in my mouth.
It's a cream cheese based frosting and
it's
surprisingly sticky.
It's so tasty.
It's hard to talk around. It is delicious.
Anyway, so
yes.
at the end of this podcast every week, we talk about Daniel Ramirez and Ben Tolliday and their music, right? So what we're going to do is give a little behind the scenes look at the theme music and how it came together.
Mm-hmm.
And here it is while I eat my cake.
My name is Daniel Ramirez, and I am an audio engineer at Marketplace.
My name is Ben Tolliday. I'm also an audio engineer at Marketplace. And together we wrote the theme music for Make Me Smart. So I'd think of the theme music as kind of a groove, acoustic guitar groove, that introduces a conversation between Kai and Molly. I'd always pictured that first riff that starts at the beginning might depict the swagger that Kai has when he walks into the studio for a broadcast or for a recording session.
I specifically remember Molly coming to us and saying, for the close, I want to feel like I have the top down in my car and the wind's blowing and there's a sense of freedom.
We tag team between engineering and playing and set up a little recording rig and brought in a bunch of instruments and made Studio A our little kind of writing, recording workspace.
We were fully prepared to label them open theme and closed theme. And then when the producers came back and said, don't you dare call them open theme and closed theme, we looked at each other and we were like, all right, we're not good at this. Let's figure out what to name them. So the open theme is called The Informant. And then the closed theme is called Spiritum Liberum, which is free spirit.
In Latin, nice.
In case that didn't make sense to you.
There
Here
we go.
It comes. Top
and
down, people.
And here's how we know we're almost done. Top down, people. Have you ever actually owned a convertible?
Yes. It was named Babs. It was the first car I bought when I moved to California, and it was a white Volkswagen Rabbit, and it was super
oh
old,
God,
and it was a convertible,
it was.
And it was the girliest vehicle.
Of course it was.
I mean, every vehicle I'd owned up to then, save for the 1968 Mustang, had been a truck until I moved to California and I bought Babs.
That's so interesting, because you're not a girly car person.
No.
At all.
To this day, it is the only girliest car I've ever owned, actually. Babs. I loved
wow.
Babs.
Wow. Mm-hmm. My convertible was a 1971 Cutlass 442 convertible, red with a white top,
that
went
awesome.
1,000 miles an hour in a straight line, and it got about a mile and a half to the gallon.
Please don't tell me you were like a teenage boy, because that is a death trap.
I was
a
24-year-old, 22-year-old Navy lieutenant with not much better to do with my time.
So pretty much Top Gun in car form, basically.
Kinda. Well, you've seen the picture, right?
Mm-mm.
Oh, we'll put it on the website, the picture of me in that car. Oh, yeah, it's great.
What?
That's a good one. Yeah, it's in my office. I'll show it to you after.
That is awesome.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. Anyway, speaking of seeing things, Ben Hethcote, who does video for us, made a video version of that Make Me Smart theme music, which you can see on our YouTube page. It is YouTube page. It's Marketplace APM. You will get to see Daniel Ramirez
see
and
them.
Ben Tolliday. And you know, they're good-looking guys, so check them out. What? Was that not appropriate?
Don't say anything inappropriate in the comments, though.
Come on.
And also, thanks for making us smarter. And to Kai for making me smarter every week there.
Well, you too. Right back at you. Right
yeah.
back at you.
No,
so
it's a good show. We love doing it.
We mentioned, we hinted at perhaps a little bit up the top, a little surprise for our 100th episode, and it is this. We have T-shirts.
T-shirts.
We have T-shirts. I'm wearing mine. Are you wearing yours?
I am.
I can see on the other
That's
side.
That's why
right,
you had to take his sweater off because he had yes. a T-shirt on.
Yes. And it's sort of a dark grayish, which says in sort of light gray letters, none of us is as smart as all of us. And then on the back, it's got Make Me Smart with Kai and Molly. And here is the big part. And listen very carefully. The first 100 people who go to marketplace.org/shop and enter a code MMS100 get the new T-shirt for free. Except you got to pay shipping. Marketplace.org/shop. The code is MMS100.
Yep. First 100 people get that T-shirt for just the cost of shipping and handling.
It's like one of those old TV commercials.
And apparently the merch shop, marketplace.org/shop, is itself new. So there's a bunch of other merch that you can look for.
I didn't know that.
I heard it in a meeting this morning.
Let us proceed with the rest of your regularly scheduled program, shall
Let
we?
Let us.
Oh, my goodness. All right, I'm going to bang mine out first just because I got here first, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, please do.
I just want to point out a thing that I saw in the Washington Post this morning from Heather Long, who's their economics correspondent. We've had her on Marketplace a bunch of times. She's really good, and she knows what she's talking about. And here's why I bring this up. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York, one of the 13 bank branches, of the Federal Reserve, comes out with reports and statistics all the time. And they came out the other day with a report that said 7 million Americans, 7 million people in this country, are 90 days or more behind on their auto loan payments.
Hmm.
And I just want to point out, as does the Fed, the New York Fed and Heather, that that's a very bad thing. When people start missing payments on something as substantive as a car, number one, mortgages are not far behind. But number two, 7 million people is a lot. And it's really troubling, especially because in an economy with low unemployment and in theory a lot of economic growth going on, the fact that people are falling behind and can't make those payments is a troubling thing. Because if you can't make a payment on a car, you lose your car, you can't get to work, you can't work, and it goes from there. So listen, auto lending is not going to bring this economy down, but the idea that so many people are having trouble making their payments is a problem.
Yeah.
I just want to point that out.
I'm gonna start with a brief recap of The Trail of Tears, which, reading from Wikipedia, it was a series of forced relocations of Native Americans in the United States from their ancestral homelands in the southeastern United States to areas in the West that had been designated as Indian Territory. The forced relocations were carried out by government authorities following the passage of the Indian Removal Act in 1830, and tens of thousands of people were forcibly relocated. These later became known as death marches. Literally thousands of people died during the actual relocations. And again, from Wikipedia, the forced relocation in the 1830s and 40s is, quote, widely considered to have directly caused the expulsion or death of a substantial part of the Indian population then living in the southeastern United States. So,
why are we talking about the trail
of tears? This is the context in which President Trump tweeted last week, "Today, Elizabeth Warren, sometimes referred to me by me as Pocahontas, joined the race for president. Will she run as our first Native American presidential candidate, or has she decided that after 32 years, this is not playing so well anymore? See you on the campaign trail, Liz." And trail is in all caps. That was widely considered to be a not very veiled reference to the Trail of Tears. And it's taken a few days for this to come into the public consciousness. Like, it didn't really, not a lot of people noticed, which I think is emblematic of how little we know about Native American history, actually, and how few advocates there are for this group.
I think you ought to explain why this got to you.
It got to me because I grew up in Montana and North Dakota, or what we, when I was growing up, called Indian Country.
Yeah.
My family always worked with youth services and runaway and homeless youth and at-risk youth. I did a lot of work on Indian reservations, and
That's not what I intended.
I know, totally.
Okay.
Anyway, this was this moment where I thought, wow, that was a unquestionably horrific thing to say. That was an unquestionably cruel tweet. If it meant what it said, it clearly violates Twitter's policy on hate speech, because references to mass murder, violent events, or specific means of violence where protected groups have been primary targets or victims are specifically prohibited by Twitter. And frankly, I was shocked that that it took people days to realize what a truly terrible thing that was to say.
So can we talk about Twitter for a minute?
Yeah.
And the fact
that's a big part of this.
Well, right. What are we to do with the fact that the president of the United States and those who follow him and many others like him in this economy and in this society can do this, and Twitter goes, I don't know.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, look, every piece of research shows a direct link between speech and action. You know, we know that when you create the environment for hate, hate occurs in physical form. And in this case specifically, Twitter is clearly complicit in allowing the spread of hateful speech. I think that is incontrovertible given their own policies, which I cut and pasted into our rundown, and the history behind this reference, and the fact that President Trump, on more than one occasion, actually, has made mocking references to Native American, like the massacre at Wounded Knee. This is like something that he does with, you know, so there's every reason to believe that this was very deliberate and extremely hurtful.
Send us your thoughts on this one. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Do it in a voicemail, and we'll get them on. And we'll see what people think, because this is, you know, it's a huge part of what's going on in this country. Mm-hmm. It just is. Deep breath. Okay?
Yes.
All right.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Yeah, buddy.
I also want to discuss a very different thing. This is why I never come to the studio, you guys, because usually I just can cry at home, which is way better. Yeah. All right. Last week, I talked about my glimpse into the future of watching the Marshmello concert on Fortnite, which I remain obsessed by. If you have no clue what I'm talking about and you haven't heard last week's episode, check it out. Or last Friday's episode of Marketplace Tech. Yep. We talked about it also. Yep. Lots of you had things to say about it. Dawn Pruitt from Tucson, Arizona, sent us this voice memo on how it reminded her of a famous sci-fi novel.
I loved your story on the Fortnite Marshmello concert. It reminded me of the book Ready Player One by Ernest Cline, which, by the way, just got made into a lackluster film.
No, I love that film. That was a great movie.
People log into virtual reality with their avatars into a place called the, quote, Oasis. Is this Fortnite concert another case of science fiction becoming reality? Thanks, Kai and Molly. Have a lucky day.
All right, Dawn. Sorry to jump on you there. I know. But holy cow, I love Ready Player
One.
I know,
we're both like, what now?
I really loved it.
It was a visual triumph.
Yeah,
I totally agree.
I thought it was great.
But to answer your question, yes, Dawn. And what's so remarkable about it is I think a lot of companies have been assuming that we needed fully immersive virtual reality to get there. And so what I thought was so transformative about this concert is like, no, we didn't. It was just like kids with headsets watching like on TV, and it felt that immersive. It was neat.
So another one, actually, on the same thing, a little different take. Rusty Essoy sent us this voice memo. He totally agrees the Marshmello show on Fortnite is the future of online interaction, but he says it's not like that's new.
Mm-hmm. Twitch, besides being the place to stream games, have also provided a place for up-and-coming music acts, DJs, folk bands, solo artists, etc., to stream their art. It's almost as if Twitch has become the virtual subway corner, where we, the audience, can tip an artist a dollar while they play live music. In fact, some of these artists, after gaining a huge following, can be tipped as much as $100. While Twitch has had a market on the subway corner, Fortnite has booked a recent Coachella act for their virtual music festival.
That's
so
cool.
So what's going to be interesting is to see who's the second mover in the space, right? Who else picks this up and goes with it, right? HBO, Netflix, somebody else, right?
Right. I mean, there have been attempts at live. Yeah. Live is really hard. So the fact that, I mean, the big difference between Fortnite and Twitch is like a lot of people stream Twitch events, but this may have been the largest concert in history as they're starting to run, like anywhere in real life too. I mean, it was maybe 10 million or more concurrent viewers watching the same thing. Bananas. In response to last week's meme episode, Cody Staub provided a historical context to the word meme, which I can't believe we missed in our intro, which is to say where it came from. He wrote, "Something I learned recently is that the term meme was coined by Richard Dawkins in The Selfish Gene from the Greek mimema, something imitated."
And now you know.
So cool. Aren't you smart now?
Make me smart. That's right. Russell Clay from Charlottesville, Virginia, thinks memes are analogous to genes in biological evolution.
Although memes aren't biological, rather, they're the smallest unit of information that can be copied from person to person. Ideas, trends, riffs in music, ways to make tools, aspects of religion and politics, all these things can be thought of as memes, and the environment that exerts selection pressure on memes is the human mind. The key is that their existence depends on humans understanding them and passing them on to other humans. So, as the evolution of species depends on the gene, because the gene is the thing that gets copied and passed on from generation to generation, the evolution of aspects of culture depends on the copying of memes. Congrats on 100 episodes, and keep them coming.
Yeah, buddy.
I love that.
Interesting.
There's a whole side note on copyright we could not do. We're not going to do it.
That's good, because I have no idea what you're talking about.
I'm never not thinking about intellectual property. I don't know about you guys.
Oh, my God. I am not
such a
often
nerd.
Anyway.
Time for the Make Me Smart question, and this is super exciting. Our producers, Eve Tro and Sharon Morris, just went to the Makers Conference, which was in Orange County this year, and it's a media project that documents and shares stories of trailblazing women, basically. And Gloria Steinem is a legendary feminist. Gloria Steinem is a major part of the project. And they got her to answer the Make Me Smart question, which is, of course, what is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about?
For a long time, I thought that if we talked about equal pay and comparable worth and all that kind of stuff would be enough. And then I realized the whole definition of work is crazy. Because a third of the work in this country, and in many, even in industrialized countries like this, is all the work of child rearing and caring and taking care of relatives. And I mean, it's a third of the productive work in the country that the country could not run without. And it is absolutely economically invisible. It doesn't have to be. You could attribute a value to it at replacement level and make it part of the economy. So I finally realized that equal pay is just only a small proportion of what we need.
Yeah, it's about representation too, right? It's about knowing that that's what's going on.
And valuing for sure. Work for what it really is. Wow, that's like a whole episode right there.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So
also,
that was, yeah.
Good get, guys.
Yeah, good get on Gloria Steinem. Yeah, super. The Make Me Smart question is, of course, what is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? Voicemail us, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Ah, Ben and Daniel.
There it is.
Ben and Daniel.
Spiritum liberum. The spirit is liberated by knowledge, you guys. Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris.
Is that what they said? Oh.
Senior producer is Eve Tro. I'm just connecting the dots from the end to the start, and maybe I overthought it like I do.
No, you
it
get
happens.
Out.
It happens.
Get out.
Mm-hmm. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. This week's program was engineered by Drew Dostad. I just looked to make sure.
Yes, it is.
Our theme music was composed, as you may have heard, by Ben Holliday and Daniel Ramirez.
Don't forget that video. It's on our Marketplace APM YouTube channel. The executive director of On Demand is Star Nieves. Senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark, who I think we all know does not listen to the end of these credits. I'm just saying.
Because she would have things
to
say.
She would have things to say.
About this APM
What about the big
thing?
Bosses in St. Paul? Do they listen to the end? We're going to find out.
Let's see.
Oh, God.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.